This is Kevin Short, and welcome to the Think Outrageous radio show. Our guest today is Jim Esquire. Jim, welcome to the show.
Kevin, thanks for having me on this morning.
Yeah, I'm very anxious to learn more about your book, Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. Why don't you talk a little bit about what motivated you to write that, and while you're doing that, give us some of your background.
Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, Kevin, is actually the second book in a series, the first of which I wrote in late 2010, early 2011. It really talks about the progression of our economy and really people's livelihoods through the economic crisis that we had in 2008, and how my assertion anyway, really haven't progressed through the full extent of the crisis due to some of the reasons I outline in the book. And the book that we're talking about right now, I published in 2015. I just last month, coincidentally, published a successor book. It's complementary to the book we're going to discuss today, and it's called Escaping Oz, an Observer's Reflections. It's a book that wrote primarily to center the discussion, I guess, that many people really need to have today. Obviously, the climate that we have in our country right now is very politically charged for a number of reasons, which I outline in the books before of why that would occur. And I think we really need to, again, to center our discussion to have some reasonable kind of cogent discussions about how we need to kind of solve some of these problems. My background academically really has nothing to do with any of these things. Coincidentally enough, I'm actually an engineer by degree. I have a couple of engineering degrees in industrial engineering. And most of my professional life was encased within the wonderful world of telecommunications, networking technology, and so forth. So I was kind of in the vanguard era of, you know, when the internet started becoming big and so forth. A few years ago, I left that industry and began a small consultancy where I help small businesses with capital acquisition and debt restructuring. I thought that that was going to be a niche market that would evolve, particularly after 2008 and the barrage of banking regulations that would descend upon the commercial banking industry. And it's obviously made it more challenging to acquire capital for a lot of small businesses. So that's a need that I saw, and I still think it's going to be, it's still consistent. That need is still there. The debt restructuring part is the one that really kind of took me by surprise. I knew that a lot of small businesses would have debt problems. But here in the St. Louis area, where you're based as well, I was amazed at the number of small businesses that are really operating on the very, very thin margins. And I don't mean just margins from an accounting perspective. I mean just even margins from a mental health perspective. And there's a lot of businesses that have been taken to court, civil litigation, as a result of debt problems. And that's really what really opened my eyes, that, you know, the state of small business in the United States.
So the book talks about navigating the crisis. Do you believe we're still in crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. What we've had since 2008, or really let's use 2009 as the bottom of the stock market and then recovery from that point, we've had an artificially led recovery as a result of, let's say, very onerous interest rate policies. And I use the word onerous because, one hand, while interest rates are historically low, good in theory, right, for a lot of borrowers, on the savings side of that, it has absolutely decapitated pensions, if you will, savers, you know, people that have money in the bank that are counting on that, interest rates, obviously, on bonds. There's so many things that have been affected by the Fed's very, you know, constricted interest rate policy. And one of the time bombs, if you will, that exists right now that will detonate at some point and it'll cause quite a tremendous commotion is obviously the pension crisis. And whether that pension is a public pension, you know, we have a state, of course, next to us, Kevin, in Illinois, that when I wrote the book in 2015, I had their pension funding for the state at 24% of their target. And now I presume it's probably worse. You know, some of the problems that they're having in that state where I think they have a pile now of $15 billion with a capital B of unpaid bills. That's an example of a future pension crisis that's going to be significant. And obviously they're one state, and you know, California obviously has their problems. New Jersey has their problems as well. In Missouri, we're in a little bit better shape, but while I caution everybody about that is at the stock market, low around, let's use 2009 again as that anchor point. The company that I worked for at the time, their pension plan had lost 35 to 40% of its plan value. There are so many pension plans, obviously, that are underfunded. I think I wrote in the 2015 book that we're discussing now, state pensions probably in the $3 to $4 trillion of underfunding. What's really significant, Kevin, is that this is with a bond market that has been historically robust, a stock market, obviously, that, you know, obviously continues to set records, and a reasonably mild real estate recovery, you know, if people had those investments. So if we're at a severe underfunding point now with these historical financial markers that are in you know, record or historically high territory, what's the situation going to be like when we encounter the next crisis, which again remains in front of us? And that's where you'll get more of that intersection, a theme that I like to use in these books is the intersection of politics and economics. And when that next crisis occurs, if you think the political environment is charged now, just wait.
So you think, I think one of your points has been that the presidential election last year is part of the consequences of the crisis. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and when I wrote my very first book, again, late 2010, early 2011, what I asserted was that we had a very significant, let's say, public anger that started to percolate. The first manifestation of that was with what we know as the Tea Party in 2009. Then we had Occupy, you know, fill in the blank in 2010 and 2011. And those are just the movements here in the United States. Overseas, there were other movements as well. So the 2008 financial crisis unleashed this wave of public anger that was, you know, it was simmering there for a while, but it became more manifest at that point in time. And one of the things I talked about that I think somewhat came to fruition in 2016 is I mentioned that when you have that sort of an environment, it opens itself up to political candidates that might not be what you would consider the traditional candidates. And let me support my argument by saying the following. In 2016, I would say there were three candidates that had, in my estimation, very strong showing that didn't fit any political party. Candidate number one was Dr. Ben Carson, who, if you recall back to the early 2016 presidential primaries on the Republican side, actually was ahead. And, you know, that very first presidential debate that they had on the Republican side had like 16 or 18 people on the stage. Well, of course, you know, the other person that emerged from that is our current 45th president, who really didn't fall in any political party. The third candidate that I'd like to mention, that who knows what might have happened in the 2016 election had it not been for some of the machinations of the DNC, is Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders, of course, is registered as an independent, but he ran as a Democrat. So my point is that you had three candidates, two very, very prominent in Sanders and Trump, that really didn't fit the mold of any of the, you know, the traditional historic candidates that you might assume from the Democratic and the GOP. My view was that perhaps he might actually run as a third party candidate. Now, that didn't happen because it's obviously very difficult to do that. But the manifestation of those types of candidates really played in 2016. And I suspect they're definitely going to go play in 2020.
It makes perfect sense. So what do you think, what foundational problems still remain in the economy?
The biggest foundational problem we have is our money system. And really this goes back many, many years. You could probably trace the most recent misstep, if you will, to something President Nixon did in 1971. And most people remember Nixon, obviously, for the Watergate scandal, but in the book, I mentioned that there's probably something that a legacy that he leaves behind that is far, far, far more significant than anything Watergate, you know, did at the time or could have spawned. And that's the decoupling of the United States from this thing called the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was a post-World War II treaty, financial treaty, which basically set the financial equivalencies of currencies all across the world. But more importantly, it set up an equivalency of the dollar to gold. Well, once that got decoupled, and again, for people that think, well, Jim's just a gold bug, that's not really the point I'm trying to make, is that if you think about probably the most important monetary agreement or treaty that was ever made, it stipulated that one of the currencies, i.e., you know, the U.S. dollar, had to be linked to something with tangible value, and that happened to be gold. Now, you can argue whether that should have been that way or not, but the reality was that's how it was set up, and we decoupled that. And you can look at a lot of financial measures in our economy, if you want to talk about wealth inequality. A lot of things changed after that decoupling. And, you know, a big, big credit cycle, in my book I talk about this, started probably around 1981 or 82 that we're still in the middle of. So foundationally, economies are very, very, let's say, shaky, don't have that solid foundation unless they have something, a strong monetary unit to anchor it. And I say this about the United States, but no other country in the world has that either. And that, of course, carries its own systemic risk as the crisis worsens.
Well, hasn't the Fed run out of dry powder? And if you agree with that, what would you expect to happen next?
The Fed is the entity that I call one of the wizards, and that's part of the theme of the Escaping Oz book. So Escaping Oz is, you know, we have these entities that we deal with financially, and I use central banks, the Federal Reserve of the United States, as one of the wizards. So if you remember the story of the Wizard of Oz, the wizard's this big, powerful being, and, you know, smoke's coming out and fire, and Dorothy is afraid, and, you know, well, what happens at one point in the movie is Toto runs around, pulls the curtain back, and then you see the wizard as an ordinary person. And that's the persona, I think, that the wizards have created for themselves, that government, you know, defaults to, you know, doing something financially, whether they do that with their own fiscal policy or with the Federal Reserve helping them out. You know, I think I have something in the book that said that during the middle of the crisis in 2008, the Secretary of the Treasury got on his hands and knees before Nancy Pelosi, you know, asking for the bailout. And this is Henry Paulson I'm talking about. So is the Fed out of dry powder? They've tried many different things. You know, they tried various forms of interest rate manipulation. They have the quantitative easing, you know, 1, 2, and 3. Now they're actually going in reverse, where it's a kind of a let's call it a quantitative tightening process, where all of those assets that they had bought with their balance sheet now at $4.5 trillion, they realize they need to rid themselves of some of those assets in a systematic manner. And so there's a plan right now that they're going to have where they're going to sell, if you will, some of those assets in a very targeted manner over the course of the, you know, however long, to get their balance sheet to a more normal level of, I think it's $2.5 trillion. Well, so that means they got to get rid of $2 trillion worth of assets. When that happens, of course, it actually takes money out of the money supply, because, you know, people are going to buy them, and then that money goes back to the Fed and basically disappears. So I don't really know what else the Fed could do at this point. What they're trying to do right now is they're trying to get the interest rate level back up to a certain point, because they anticipate another financial crisis as well. And what they normally do reflexively is, okay, well, we have to lower interest rates. Well, you can't lower interest rates when they're pretty close to the zero bound right now, unless you go to a negative interest rate. And there's some, I think there's some social and political implications of trying something like that. So I'm not really sure what they're going to do, honestly, during the next crisis, because whenever these different crises has occurred, where, you know, 1998 was long-term capital management that the banks stepped in. Then you had the 2008 crisis where the banks were in trouble in the Fed. Well, who's going to bail out the Fed? There's some thought that, you know, you need to start with another organization that would have a clean balance sheet, you know, whether that's the, you know, International Monetary Fund and so forth. Just a quick digression here. I actually explore some of those themes in a fictional sense in a novel series that I wrote, the first of which is called 2020, which talks about the 2020 presidential election and some of the things that would be going on then. But yeah, I kind of agree with you. The Fed is probably, you know, doesn't have the same tools. I mean, they've tried their tools, and obviously we have this result that we do now.
Do you have a sense, if you're going to predict the future, of what's going to derail the economy? You know, we're all sitting here watching the Trump administration kind of wobble and wiggle and does some good things and then has a good day and then four bad days and a good day. And you know, gives everybody a little bit of pause. Wall Street doesn't seem to be bothered by it. It continues upwards. What do you think the Trump administration is going to do? What effect will it have on the economy as we move forward? And do you see any other hurdles coming, landmines coming in the economy we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, great question. You know, before the 2016 election, the market, you know, and I was talk about this on a fundamental analysis basis, the market had priced in, if you will, a Democratic victory. Well, that didn't occur. And then on election night and over, you know, overnight trading, the market plummeted, but then somehow then it made a tremendous recovery. Then all of a sudden the market, and this is what happens with markets, they tend to rationalize, and this is, you know, mass psychology we're talking about here. So on the one hand, for 1 second, it was, okay, well, if the Republican wins, then the market's going to go to hell. Then all of a sudden, it manifested in the opposite direction. Well, if the Republican wins, that means we're going to have tax reform, we're going to have health care reform, we're going to have infrastructure spending, and so forth. So from a fundamental perspective, from a market psychology perspective, the market has built in the successful resolution of those three things that I just mentioned. Well, if anybody's following the news right now, you can see that step one of that is, you know, has not come to fruition, right? The healthcare reform is on life support, if not near dead already. So then you have tax reform, you know, then you have infrastructure spending, which is in the trillions of dollars, or at least $1 trillion that he was thinking about. On top of all that, you have a temporary budget right now that I believe only goes into effect, or only carries us until the end of the government's fiscal year on September 30th. So what's going to happen with the new budget? And remember, this is without, you know, imagine that they get there around September and you don't have any of these other things done. So that's the uncertainty that's being created right now. And I'm not pinning this on Donald Trump. I'm just saying these are the things that are extant right now in Washington D.C. that is in the minds of those people that trade on Wall Street, and that sort of optimism that was there. Oh, we have a businessman now, and it's going to help. Well, the market psychology can turn on a number of things. And one of those that I mentioned is some of these events that haven't occurred yet. There's the federal budget. There's also the potential for the crisis of, you know, maybe occurring in a state, maybe a debt issue that doesn't get fulfilled, maybe somebody misses a payment. Obviously, you know, geopolitical factors are always potential as well. So as we move forward into the fall season, there are more risks that will affect the market. And I talk about this more extensively in the book about cycles. And if you look at a lot of the numerical measures in the market right now, I mean, I just saw this morning, the VIX is under 10, you know, the volatility measure. The market is really priced in really what I would consider more Goldilocks territory. And there's other things as well about, you know, the price earnings ratio, and, you know, bull markets don't start from where we are right now. Typically that's the start of bear markets. And so, unfortunately, a lot of times what happens is the person that's in presidential office tends to bear the brunt of the blame for this. So I suspect that when things start to devolve a little bit, and as chaotic, obviously, as things have been for the current 45th presidential administration, I think they'll probably get a little bit more so.
Makes sense. Great to catch up, Jim. Thank you for joining us today. Let our listeners know how to find you, your website, and where they can get your book.
The best place to really make contact with me is on my author site, which is jimmosquera.com. And let me spell that out. That's JIMMOSQUERA.com. That will get you to my author website. I actually have a domain for the Escaping Oz book that we talked about right now, which is escapingoz.com, ESCAPINGOZ.com, escapingoz.com. Either one will get you to my author site.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us today, and thank you to our listeners for thinking outrageously on a daily basis and joining the Think Outrageous radio show. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.